This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines. Iran condemns foreign interference in internal affairs, saying countries known for warmongering and violence cannot preach others on human rights. The family of a Palestinian journalist fatally shot by Israeli forces files an official lawsuit with the International Criminal Court demanding justice for her killing. And pro-Russian separatists in several parts of Ukraine are to hold referendums on joining Russia. Hello, everyone. A very warm welcome to World News. Our top story, Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson has once again slammed foreign interference in the country's internal matters. He says certain countries with a long history of warmongering and violence are in no position to preach to others the issue that is of human rights. Nasser Kanani was reacting to meddlesome remarks by some American and European officials on the case of a young Iranian woman who collapsed at a police station and later died at hospital. He advised those countries to avoid opportunism and instrumental use of human rights. Kanani said the U.S. is the biggest violator of rights of Iranians by keeping its failed maximum pressure policy and economic terrorism. He said the West is turning a blind eye to crimes committed by allies across the world only reveals its hypocrisy in the issue of human rights. Kanani called for Western governments to improve their own human rights situation and stop seditious activities. The Iranian president says reaching a nuclear agreement is not possible without closing the Islamic Republic's case with the International Atomic Energy Agency. Ebrahim Raisi said the IAEA has officially acknowledged, quote, 15 times Iran's activities are based on commitment and far from deviation. Raisi said Europe must prove its policies are independent from Washington. He said revival of the 2015 accord hinges on guarantees provided by parties to the agreement. Raisi was meeting with his French counterpart on the sidelines of the 77th UN General Assembly. Washington broke its promises under the deal by withdrawing back in mid-2018. Tehran says the European sides have not acted according to their obligations under the JCPOA. The family of slain Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh has submitted an official complaint with the International Criminal Court demanding justice for her killing. In a statement, Abu Akleh's family said footage shows she was explicitly targeted by Israeli forces despite wearing a vest marked press. The statement added that regime forces even prevented her colleague from helping her after she was shot. Abu Akleh was killed on the 11th of May while covering an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. Earlier, an Israeli investigation claimed that the reporter was likely shot unintentionally by an Israeli soldier. Abu Akleh's family, however, says the regime is trying to obscure the truth and avoid responsibility for killing the journalist. Pro-Russian separatists in several Ukrainian regions say they will hold referendums on joining Russia in the coming days. Self-proclaimed Luhansk People's Republic passed a law earlier Tuesday outlining the details of the proposed vote. Russian media cited sources as saying vote is set to take place between September 23rd and the 27th. The self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic also plans a vote on secession from Ukraine as well. Authorities in the Russian-controlled southern Kherson region and southeastern Zaporizhia also said that they'll hold similar referendums no later than September 27th. Moscow says it's up to the residents of those regions to decide if they want to be part of Russia.
From the very beginning of the special military operation and before that, we've been saying that the peoples of the prospective territories should decide their own fate. The whole current situation confirms that they want to be master of their own fate.
Coordinated moves have sparked Kiev's angry reaction, with the government pledging to eliminate Moscow's threat. The Ukrainian foreign minister says the proposed referendums will not change anything on the ground. The U.S., Germany, and NATO have called the planned votes a sham. NATO says that the referendums are yet another escalation in the Ukraine war. France has called them a travesty. And now the latest updates out of Ukraine. Government forces there have advanced further into the east, reclaiming more areas from Russian troops. Video posted online shows Ukrainian soldiers walking on a road in Bilohorivka after regaining control there, just west of the Russian-held city of Lysychansk. Ukrainian officials say soldiers are now in full control of the area and preparing to retake entire province of Luhansk. Ukrainian troops have launched a counteroffensive in the eastern region since driving Russian forces out of northeastern Kharkiv province earlier in the month. Meanwhile, the Russian Defense Ministry says its forces destroyed an armored vehicle repair plant in southern Ukraine. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres opens the 77th session of the General Assembly in New York with a stark warning to international leaders that the world is grappling with multiple crises. Here he is.
Excellencies, we need action across the board. Let's have no illusions. We are in rough seas. A winter of global discontent is on the horizon. A cost of living crisis is raging. Trust is crumbling. Inequalities are exploding. And our planet is burning. People are hurting, with the most vulnerable suffering the most.
This is the first in-person gathering of world leaders at the 193-member General Assembly after 2 years of COVID restrictions. UN chief stressed cooperation and dialogue is the only path forward, adding, no power or group alone can call the shots. He said that geopolitical divides have made the world unable to tackle major challenges threatening the future of humanity. Guterres also pointed out the dire state of the planet, lashing out at fossil fuel companies. The war in Ukraine and mounting economic and environmental crises are on top of the agenda of this year's UN General Assembly meeting. The Russian president has slammed what he calls efforts by some countries to preserve their global dominance, saying such attempts are doomed to fail.
This objective development towards multipolarity unfortunately encounters the resistance of those who want to maintain the role of hegemon in world affairs and control everything. Latin America, Europe, Asia, and Africa. But it cannot go on like this forever. It's impossible. I'm even talking about this now outside the context of the events that are taking place in Ukraine.
Putin made the remarks while receiving the credentials of foreign ambassadors to Moscow. He also censured the U.S. and its Western allies for imposing illegitimate sanctions and putting pressure on other nations, including Russia, in order to consolidate their own positions. He said such actions will have a boomerang effect on those countries themselves. Putin added that Russia will not give up its sovereign right. He also noted his country is pursuing a unifying interstate agenda. He said that is to help find effective responses to numerous global challenges and threats and resolve acute regional conflicts. Putin said Russia will underline a such stance at the 77th session of the General Assembly. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov will address the summit on Saturday. A large business delegation from Russia has visited Iran to explore areas of cooperation. This comes as Tehran and Moscow are planning to increase trade amid U.S. sanctions. Press TV's Yusuf Jalali reports.
Iran and Russia are taking their trade ties to the next level. Some 100 companies from Russia are in Tehran to network with Iranian businesses and find areas of cooperation in a range of fields, from food to oil and gas and the automotive industry.
We produce technological machinery for different industries, including in the automotive sector. Today, we talked to several Iranian companies, and I am sure we will launch a joint venture with a number of them.
The company is specialized in production of equipment for the air pollution control, to control the emissions of plants and factories. And now we are going to enter this market again, and we hope to do it through this business mission.
We supply the oil, gas, and petrochemical equipment, machinery, instrument in Iran. We are distributors, some companies from the European Iran.
Tehran and Moscow's interests coincide on many fronts. Both are faced with U.S. sanctions, and both are signatories to the 2015 deal, which has faced troubles following the U.S. withdrawal from the pact in 2018 and the reinstatement of sanctions on Iran. While the sanctions have adversely affected Iran and Russia's foreign trade, businessmen here believe there's a strong will from both Tehran and Moscow to overcome the U.S. measures.
The sanctions cannot be a serious obstacle to business activities between us and Russians, because if there is a will to do business, there's a way. The U.S. measures can only complicate the payment channels for us, but we can do our transactions via our national currencies.
This event came on the heels of the Iranian president's meeting with his Russian counterpart on the sidelines of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit in Uzbekistan, where the two sides vowed to further develop bilateral trade. Last year, Tehran and Moscow traded some $4 billion U.S. dollars worth of commodities. The two countries are set to increase this figure beyond $15 billion in the coming years.
Tehran and Moscow are already strategic partners, not only in politics, but also in trade and security. But it seems that the two sides are poised to expand their ties at all levels, believing that closer engagement will open a back door for them to neutralize U.S. sanctions. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Over 500 dock workers at the port of Liverpool in Britain have launched a two-week strike over salaries. Port operatives and maintenance engineers are striking for a 20% pay raise. Walkout is the latest to disrupt rail services across the country. Britain has witnessed a host of industrial action over the past few months. Walkouts are due to inflation, which topped 10% mark in July, and it's been projected to go beyond 13% next month. Rise in food and energy prices has worsened the cost of living crisis that's already hit households and businesses across the United Kingdom. And earlier, we discussed Brazil's upcoming presidential election with our guests in our news review program. Here it is.
Time now for the news review. Now listen, 2 weeks ahead of Brazil's presidential elections, an opinion poll shows incumbent Jair Bolsonaro lagging behind his main rival, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. According to an IPEC survey, the far-right president is now backed by 31% of the voters. That against 47% to support former President Lula. The study expects a runoff in which Lula would win by 54% of the ballots against 35% for Bolsonaro. The incumbent has seen his popularity drop due to his controversial management of the coronavirus pandemic and the economy. He said that he will retire from politics if he fails to win the upcoming vote. Okay, two guests will be joining me to shed some more light on this and discuss that a bit. So our own correspondent, Camila Escalante, both of them are in Brazil. Bruno Biclini, academic and political scientist, is also there. Good to see you both. So, Camila, starting with you, tell us about the campaign plans. Only 2 weeks remain. So what are the two main contenders are going to do? And should we expect any change in the opinion polls that I just talked about?
Well, we saw 3 days of a tour here through the southern region of Brazil, where I am now. And sorry, I'm hearing a little bit of feedback, but Lula da Silva came down to the southern region of Brazil for a 3-state tour where he held massive rallies in what is known as a stronghold for the right wing and Jair Bolsonaro. But we saw massive turnout in favor of Lula da Silva, and as you said, the polls actually showed Lula with a slight boost. Now we see Jair Bolsonaro growing a little bit desperate, perhaps, with the risk that this could all end in just one round, because Lula is kind of right there on the margin, where he could potentially win without need for a second round. But it's difficult to say as of right now. Today we saw Jair Bolsonaro at the opening of the general debate of the UN General Assembly in New York. He was the first speaker, and he's being charged by his critics of actually using the podium at the United Nations, where he's supposed to represent the whole of Brazil and the Brazilian people and government, and using it for political campaign purposes. He made a number of false claims there at the podium, including saying that he had worked in favor of many women's issues, that he had helped stomp out femicide. And he also said that under his government, under his administration, that there are lower numbers of rural area of violence. Ask any of the agrarian reform and land movements here who fight against the large landholders. So a lot of false information was coming from that grand podium, that grand platform, and people are very angry about that and are seeing it as a desperate attempt to try to get together a little bit more support so that Lula doesn't take it in that first round.
All right. Now, Bruni, tell us what is it that has made Jair Bolsonaro fall from grace? And we believe that maybe he's also expecting to lose this time around.
Well, Bolsonaro is what it is, and he doesn't need any enemy. He elects his enemies, and his behavior is so bad. For example, like the colleague said before, he tried to make an attempt to be more sympathizing with women, but he's himself, he's a womanizer. He made a sexist joke
it's more than
in front
sympathy.
Of his wife okay. during September the 7th. So we would say that he's his worst enemy, and his political economy during the 3.5 years in government was strictly related to the Chicago boy minister of economy of himself, Paulo Guedes. It was just like the Chilean political economy during dictatorship. And then in the last 3 to 4 months, he tried to make an attempt like used to do Mauricio Macri in Argentina, doing some social policies, but without losing the gap that we are now. For example, Brazil is the second biggest worldwide food producer, and we have 33 million people under poverty and hungry and hunger people. So,
right. Now, Camila, tell us what is it that Brazilian people are mostly asking for? What do they expect their new president to do for them?
Absolutely. I mean, some of the same things that we've seen people call for in all countries right now amid the international conflict overseas is people want price stability. They want a freeze on inflation. They want to be able to afford the basic necessities that they've always needed. And they want, you know, secure jobs. They want employment, access to housing. You know, just very basic, practical economic measures is what they want implemented in this country. And they don't see Bolsonaro as being fit to govern over the coming problems that are going to happen in the world. Like you said, following coronavirus, and now in the context of this international conflict, they want the same common sense measures that Lula and his government applied when they were in government previously. That's what they're demanding right now. So what Lula is doing right now is he's meeting with different sectors, as artists, social movements, even former presidential candidates, and even some people, the political leaders, of the center right. He's trying to bring together all sorts of people who are on the fence and who don't agree with Bolsonaro's policies and bring them over to his coalition to support him going forward in these elections. We've actually seen a number of endorsements from people that we didn't think we would see endorsing Lula coming forth and saying that, you know, a vote for a third party candidate, any of the, you know, smaller candidates with single digit support right now in the polls, is a wasted vote. And it is, in fact, a vote for Bolsonaro right now, when we're in a situation where the people say that this is an election about fascism or about returning stability and dignity to the country.
Okay, we hope a better future for all Brazilians. Thank you so much, Camila Escalante, Bruno Bicalini, both of them in Brazil.
And that's a wrap for your latest. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
in the limelight.
The last Israeli regime brutal assault on the Gaza Strip exposed once more the hypocritical and immoral response of the West to the ongoing genocidal policies of the Zionist regime in the occupied territories. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Ilan Papp, author. This article is published under the heading, "When will the West publicly endorse the right of the Palestinians to defend themselves?" Stay tuned for more. The last Israeli regime brutal assault on the Gaza Strip exposed once more the hypocritical and immoral response of the West to the ongoing genocidal policies of the Zionist regime in the occupied territories. The continuation of the callous policies and the Western government's responses, in particular the American and British ones, can naturally lead to desperation and paralysis. However, despair and inaction are a luxury Palestinians under apartheid, siege, and occupation cannot afford. Therefore, the solidarity movement as well should do its best not to give in to a sense of helplessness, of hopelessness. It is important to record the continued insecurity of the West as it transpired once more this time, condemn this duplicity and counter it by exposing the fabrications and distortions on which it is based. The American president, the State Department, and the American envoy to the United Nations supported the Zionist regime's right, as they claim, to defend itself in reaction to the Zionist regime's assault, as did the British Foreign Secretary, who will probably be the next prime minister in September. It is quite incredible to hear these statements at a time when every major human and civil rights organization on the globe defined the fake regime of Israel as an apartheid regime. The Western political elites chose to hail its right to self-defense. We should not tire and remind the world that the people who have the right to defend themselves are the Palestinians, and that they possess very limited means to do so, whether by armed struggle or by appealing to international law and institutions. In many cases, they were unable to defend themselves, neither in Gaza this month nor anywhere else in historical Palestine since 1948. When they do succeed in doing so, they are accused of being terrorists. The Western regime seemed to care very little for the Palestinian right to life, dignity, and property. The UN committed to doing so in Resolution 181 of November 29, 1947, and stood by when all these rights were violated during the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Since then, and in particular since 1967, none of the Western regimes ever attempt to protect the Palestinians when the Zionist regime army shot, killed, or wounded them with weapons supplied by the West or developed by its help. It also did nothing when their houses were demolished, their livelihood destroyed, or when they were ethnically cleansed. We can look at July 2022 alone and record some of the Palestinian victims whose rights to self-defense has not been recognized by the President of the USA or the Foreign Minister of Britain. These politicians were silent when during this month Saadia Farangla Matar, a 64-year-old mother of 8 and a grandmother of 28, died in the Damon jail, where she had already spent 6 months detained without trial. No one defended or acknowledged the right of life. In this very same month of Amjad Abu Aliyah, a 16-year-old boy who was shot by Israeli regime troops, The list of those murdered just this month is long. It includes Nabil Ghanem, 53 years old, who tried to return home safely from working in the occupied territories and was shot dead by Israeli regime troops last July, and Taher Khalil Muhammad Maslat, a 16-year-old boy, shot on his way to school by Israeli regime snipers, who aimed at him from a distance of 100 meters and killed him. Ohed Mohammed Odeh was shot dead in July in Almida, a village near Ramallah, a week that also saw the killing of Ayman Mahmoud Mohsen, aged 29, a father of three and a political prisoner for 3 years, who was killed in the Shia camp near Beitla, and Bilal Awad Khapa, aged 24, killed in Yabad. As the month just started, Muhammad Abdullah Saleh Suleiman, a boy from Silvan, was shot on Route 60, a settler apartheid road, by Israeli regime troops sitting on a watchtower. He was left to bleed for about 2 hours, with Israeli regime troops preventing a Palestinian ambulance to reach him by firing on anyone approaching him. Muhammad died later from his wounds. The Zionist regime watchtowers are also spread near the Gaza Strip fence, but they are not manned. They are loaded with machine guns operated from the distance by young Israeli women troops, who were hailed by Israeli regime radio as heroines defending their homeland when they explained how they use a joystick on their computer to kill anyone approaching the fence. Since January 1, 2022, and until the Israeli regime assassination of Shirin Abu Akleh, the Zionist regime forces killed 61 Palestinians. These killings were part of what local and international human rights organizations described as a shoot-to-kill policy against Palestinians, prodded by Israeli regime Prime Minister at the time, Naftali Bennett, to use lethal force at Palestinians who did not pose an imminent threat. Hundreds were wounded during Ramadan this year, in particular at Haram al-Sharif. As the death toll grew in this last attack, children such as Mumin Salim, aged 5, and Ahmad al-Nairab, aged 11, in Jabalia were killed, together with another 14 children between the ages of 4 to 16. Palestinian children also died because of the Zionist regime policy of denying medical permits to Gaza's children. Around 840 children have died while awaiting permits between 2008 and 2021. Nobody in the Western media or mainstream politics talked about the rights of the Palestinians who were maimed by Israeli regime shots this month to defend themselves. Nassim Shoman, a student walking on a side road near Ramallah, lost a leg, and his friend Osayed Hamayel was left paralyzed in a wheelchair after they were shot by Israeli regime troops. A similar fate this month awaited Harun Abu Aram from Yatta, who remained paralyzed from head to toes after he tried to prevent the troops of the Israeli regime from stealing his neighbor's generator. Similar silence was heard loud and clear from Western media when the Palestinian community of Ras Al Tin, 18 families, were expelled from their homes last July, and when families in Masafer Yatta became targets for the Israeli regime military training. Nobody in London or Washington last July talked about the right of the Palestinians to defend themselves in the wake of Israeli regime Supreme Court's decision to approve the army's plan to expel about 1,000 Palestinians from the Masafer Yatta region, and nobody in the official West talked about the right of those Palestinians who are tortured by the fake regime of Israel to defend themselves. Last July, we learned from the Public Committee Against Torture in the Occupied Territories that the situation has become so bad that it decided to refer the Israeli regime to International Criminal Court. PCATI concluded that the Israeli regime is not interested and unable to stop the use of torture against Palestinians, a policy that constituted a war crime. It said that after 30 years of fighting torture, it had reached the unfortunate conclusion that the Zionist regime has no wish to end torture, honestly, investigate victims' complaints, and prosecute those responsible. Who will defend the Palestinians from the need to choose between two callous options in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip? No one offers a third option. When will the leaders of the West publicly endorse the right of the Palestinians to defend themselves, as they do, for instance, in Ukraine?
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss about the problems, questions, and issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Professor Salman Naqvi. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Professor Salman Naqvi is a faculty member at the Al Mustafa University and also a researcher on the Islamic issues in the Hawza Ilmi Afka. All right, we have been talking about parents as educators, and we reached a point, a very important point that you differentiated in the previous episode, was that emotional things are not only always that come out of that subconscious thinking or irrational thinking. Our emotions can be guided by rational thinking as well. As we saw, the highest level of emotions in the event of Karbala, that had a very sound reasoning. You explained that all. Now, in order to bring that emotional development in our children, what else would you like to share?
Actually, when we deal with our children or with any other human beings, when we are engaged in a relationship, there are many feelings and emotions which are there, which are expressed in our behavior. But those feelings and emotions emanate from anxieties and stresses that we have.
Yeah.
We are maybe as a parent, as a father, or a working mother, even when we are at work and we are facing so many challenges at work, when we come home, that baggage comes with us.
Okay.
Or when we are, for example, studying at a college or a university and we have children, we are stressed up about our studies, or many other things which are there in our lives, many challenges which are there. So sometimes we can't relieve ourselves of those pressures in the workplace.
Yeah.
And those feelings and emotions which have become pent up in us, they are released at home relationships, because that's the most easiest way of doing so. You, when you go to the place of work, you are facing your boss and you can't even talk in front of him in a higher tone.
Tone, yeah.
So you feel stressed up and you come home and you relieve that pressure in front of your children.
In front of your children, unfortunately.
And on your children. So that is a very difficult situation. I mean, what's their fault?
Because that way a child is learning how to deal with his wife tomorrow, how to deal with his own children tomorrow. If he is stressed outside, he can easily bash out at the family. That's what we are actually teaching our children.
Of course. So when we say a child has become trigger happy, I mean trigger happy becomes trigger happy because he sees his parents become trigger happy, not in the literal sense that they start using a pistol or a gun or no, they start shouting at each other. For example, parents, if they're not able to manage the relationship between themselves and they are quarreling and fighting and shouting at each other and abusing each other, so what impression is that going to give to their children? So that is very important, that before we even think of having children, we should be able to manage our own feelings and emotions. The anger, we have to learn how to manage our anger. Anger is not a bad thing. Anger can, in some situations, changes into it is a form of your
self-defense.
Self-defense, exactly. I mean, according to one school of thought of ethics and morals, anger, which is called ghadab,
yeah,
in the fear, that is, it has
positive side as well.
It has a positive side. Right. It is expressed in courage.
Yeah.
And a negative side.
We want to know more on that, actually, how it is a good thing and how we can teach our children it's a good thing. After a short break, dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are with Professor Salman Naqavi and we're discussing the control of emotions. Well, you said anger is a good thing. How?
So let me talk about one of the ahadiths which has been narrated and quoted. Imam Ali alayhi salam has been quoted as saying that, look, human beings, when Allah Almighty created the human beings, He created them with two things which He had given to the other creations. For example, He said, Allah Almighty created the angels,
yeah,
and made them pure intellects.
Okay.
Angels have no anger, they have no desires, they have no feelings, they have no emotions.
They're only intellectual creations.
They're intellectual creations, pure. And if you want to relate intellect with light,
okay,
they're light objects, for example, shining things, intellectual, pure lights, shining things, for example.
Okay.
Just as a metaphor, of course, because being intellectual is much beyond that. Then he says that he created the animals with two faculties. One faculty of anger, which is called ghadab in Arabic.
Yeah.
Anger. And the other is of desires and lust.
Okay.
And in my words, and as you has also mentioned, anger is a self-defense mechanism that is there in all animals. They protect themselves from harm.
Because we believe that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is Hakim, He's wise.
Exactly.
He does everything on the basis of wisdom.
Desires,
so if he's putting this anger in a human being, it must be for some good thing.
Exactly. Exactly. And the second thing is the desires he has, things the animal, whoever they have desires or lusts, they want to acquire those things which sustain them and make them survive in the environment.
Yeah.
So they need to attract, they need to absorb food and other things.
Yeah.
The need for the opposite sex.
Yeah.
These are all based on these desires that are there in the animals.
Yeah.
And then Imam Ali says that he created, Allah Almighty created the human beings with both things.
Mm-hmm.
Intellect.
And as well as the
anger and the desires of the animals.
Okay.
So as far as the human being is an animal, has animal instincts, which are there in other animals.
Yeah.
The anger, as we said, the self-defense mechanism.
True.
And which is necessary for survival also.
Yeah.
And the desires for attracting and absorbing things which are necessary to sustain life. Food is necessary for sustaining life.
Yeah. So we came to a conclusion that anger is actually a good thing because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala acts with wisdom. So he would not put anything in a human being which is not for his benefits. Well, we'll talk more on that topic after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Regarding the sixth verse of Surah At-Tahrim, the 66th surah of the Holy Quran, that is, O you who have faith, save yourselves and your families from a fire. Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam said, save your families from fire by enjoining them to do good and forbidding them from evil deeds.
يَا مُطِيَ الْخَيْرَاتِ يَا مُطِيَ الْخَيْرَاتِ.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about the emotional development in children and how parents can act as guiders over there. Well, Professor Nakavi, you made a very good discussion on anger is one of the qualities that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has put in a human being. But we as parents often tell our children that anger is a bad thing. Anger is a bad thing. One should not get angry. One should not get angry. Do you think apart from telling children that anger is a bad thing, we can actually teach them it's a self-defensive thing? You have to have anger where you see Islamic guidelines being, you know, they're not being worked upon society. If you were a male, you need to have that male feeling when you're seeing female without hijab. And also you need to have that, what we call in other words as gairat in one of the languages. So what do you say about that?
Yes, if you allow me, I would like to recall the hadith which I mentioned from Imam Ali that was quoted from Imam Ali. We were talking about the relationship between rationality and emotions. It is brought about in this hadith by Imam Ali, alayhi salam. He says, if, as I said, that the human being has the intellectual faculty as angels have, and also has the animal instincts in the form of anger and desires.
Yeah.
Now, he says, whoever is able to bring about these two faculties, the animal instincts, under the authority or under the influence of the intellect,
mm-hmm.
becomes angel-like. Rather, he even surpasses and excels the angels. He can achieve heights where angels cannot even go there. The Holy Prophet, on the Laylatul Mi'raj, when he went to the heavens, there was a stage, Sidratul Muntaha, where the archangel Gabriel said, I can't go further.
Beyond
that. So the human being can surpass angels.
All right.
When at each stage of perfection,
mm-hmm.
which is much beyond the angels.
All right.
But if he, on the other hand, his anger, his lust and desires subdue his intellect, he falls to a low lower level, even worse than animals.
All right. So we came to know about a lot of points that there could be a human being can go even beyond angels if he goes towards the proximity, and he can even
able to manage his desires.
And he can even get lower, worse than animals. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you want to listen again, you can go back to our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. You can go to the tab, Call of Islam, and out there you can search Islamic Upbringing, and you'll find all our episodes over there. Thank you so much for being with us once again. And in case you have any questions, you have any issues, you have any anything you want to ask about the Islamic upbringing of your children, you can feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until another session, fi amanallah, God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returns upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Although most of the world news outlets and networks censored the great event of Arba'in, which this year happened to be on September 19th, this event was covered by some media to some extent. Arba'in is 40th day after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his companions on the day of Ashura in 61 AH in Karbala. Millions of Muslims as well as non-Muslims from across the world walk tens of kilometers to get to the holy shrine of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, in Karbala on Arba'in Day. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for more. Kayhan International wrote, this year's Arba'in, or the 40th day commemoration ceremonies for the Chief of Martyrs, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, climaxed in Karbala on a grand scale with a record 21 million plus pilgrims, the largest ever gathering anywhere on earth, in an atmosphere of faith and fraternity, transcending all barriers and announcing to the world that the spirit of brotherhood knows no narrow divisions of politics, class, creed, ethnicity, geography, language, and the like. This is the message of peace and justice, for the defense of which the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, preferred to court martyrdom in valiant combat against heavy odds, along with his devout followers, who numbered less than 100, rather than acknowledge the rule of a tyrant and his promotion of vices in society. The presence in the Arba'in ceremonies in Karbala of several non-Muslims, including the chief Christian patriarch of the Caucasus Republic of Georgia in his traditional attire, is further proof of the fact that the message of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, is universal, and his sacrifice was for safeguarding all humanitarian values. No wonder the most massive of the Arba'in marches, that is, the 80-kilometer trek from Najaf to Karbala, witnessed pilgrims from at least 80 countries of the world waving their national flags along with the banners of Ya Hussein and chanting elegies in their own languages. There were 5 million foreign pilgrims, with the majority being the 3.5 million devotees from neighboring Iran, where in Tehran and all over the country, the Day of Arba'in saw millions of those who were not able to go to Karbala hold several kilometer-long rallies to pay tributes to Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Similar marches on foot were held in Lebanon, Nigeria, Turkey, Afghanistan, the Caucasus Republic of Azerbaijan, Syria, and Yemen, while in Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, despite the restrictions placed by the authoritarian regimes, the people took to the streets, rhythmically stroking their chests with chants of Ya Hussein. The next day, that is Sunday, because of the late sighting of the crescent of the month of Safar in the subcontinent, millions of people marked Arba'in with lengthy processions on the streets of the cities of India and Pakistan. The Iraqi people, for their part, as usual, spared no efforts to display the finest form of hospitality for pilgrims by providing them free of the charge foods, fruits, drinks, and even places to take rest and sleep before resuming the journey to Karbala. As a matter of fact, these selfless endeavors, without any government support, showed the true nature of the Muslim masses of Iraq, who have rarely witnessed peace in history and have always been persecuted by the dictatorial regimes of Baghdad, culminating in the godless, repressive rule of the Ba'athist minority, which had banned Arba'in and other pilgrimages and massacred those observing them. No wonder throughout the Arba'in rallies in the Iraqi and Iranian Muslims, to the exasperation of the U.S., the Zionist regime and Arab reactionary regimes that are trying to fan flames of sedition, joined each other, merging their national flags and were often heard saying, "We are one people." As a matter of fact, the peace, progress and prosperity of the peoples of Iraq and Iran are inextricably tied to each other, as well as the security and stability of their respective countries. This was firmly evident by this year's Arba'in rituals, which again prove that Iraq and Iran enjoy an unbreakable bond, a bond based on the firm basis of history, religion, and the future that has enabled Iraqis to withstand the Ottoman occupation, the nightmare of the Ba'athist rule, the U.S. invasion, and the abortive bid to create Takfiristan by macabrely murderous terrorists. Al Monitor wrote, "Dressed in black, 21 million pilgrims from around the world massed in the Iraqi city of Karbala on Saturday for the Arbaeen commemoration. The annual festival sees men and women from across Iraq and beyond travel to Karbala, where Imam Hussein and his brother Abbas are buried, for one of the world's largest religious gatherings. After 2 years marked by the COVID pandemic and border restrictions, 21.2 million pilgrims have flocked to the city in central Iraq," said the organization that manages Hazrat Abbas Mausoleum. Arab News also wrote, 20 million pilgrims, swelled by a record influx of Iranians, have converged on the Iraqi shrine city of Karbala to mark Arbaeen, an annual Shi'ite festival that climaxes on Saturday. It is one of the world's biggest religious gatherings observed in Iraq and neighboring Iran, both Shiite-majority countries. The event marks the end of a 40-day mourning period for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Al Jazeera English also covered this event, saying about 21 million Shia pilgrims from around the world gathered in the Iraqi city of Karbala for the Arbaeen commemoration, which marks the end of the 40-day mourning period for the 7th century martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The annual event sees men and women from across Iraq and beyond travel to Karbala, where Imam Hussein and his companions were buried, for one of the world's largest religious gatherings. After 2 years marked by the COVID-19 pandemic and border restrictions, 21.2 million pilgrims flocked to the city in central Iraq, said the organization that manages Hazrat Abbas Mausoleum.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio.